Welcome to Building 72, the podcast brought to you by the Entertainment Arts and Engineering Program at the University of Utah. Thank you for joining your hosts, Adam Hunter and Corinne Lewis, to talk about the video game industry and, you know, probably other stuff.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Building 72, the EAE podcast. I am Adam Hunter. I am EAE's Industry and Alumni Manager. With me, as always, is Corinne Lewis, who is the undergrad director and faculty extraordinaire. And then we also have a very special guest with us today. His name is Sterling Pierce, but I'm going to let him introduce himself and tell you all about him and the adventures of his life. So, Sterling, what do you got for us? Who are you? What do you do? Who are you? Where are you from? All that fun stuff.
Where am I from? Well, I don't know if they can see this, but here I've got my EAE, Entertainment Arts and Engineering shirt. I'm a graduate at the University of Utah, cohort 2. So I can just say it's a pleasure to be able to sit down with both of you today. And so what have I been doing since I graduated from the University of Utah? I went out to a little studio. I don't know if anybody has heard of it. It's called Electronic Arts out here in Tiburon. We're located out in Orlando, Florida. And so we make a few small titles. One in particular is Madden. I don't know if anybody's heard of that. We do Madden console, Madden mobile, NBA mobile, and NBA live on console as well.
Those are all real-time strategy games, right?
Like, yes, all real. Actually, yeah, real-time strategy simulation games. Yep, absolutely.
Yep.
you're actually not far off, because it depends on what the AI throws at you in terms of defensive strategies and tactics. Also, it's one of a central. We have a lot of central teams that are out here at Tiburon too. In particular, we have a team that works with Frostbite. And so that was one of EA's fundamental cores of what they wanted to is could go to common tech. And Frostbite was one of the common tech emphasis that they have structured within EA. So Madden has ingrained themselves into Frostbite, and NBA Live was also looking to go that path. They're also looking to expand it to go into mobile as well. So, I have since left that. I have now joined a company in a studio called Pipework Studios. They're based out of Eugene, Oregon, and I am a producer there. And so we can dive into a little bit more of what I was doing at EA, what I'm currently doing now, and what I'm going to do for the future. Oh, but I did want to mention that you did forget on Corinne's introduction how she's one of the greatest individuals in the world that I've ever had the pleasure of working with. So,
I mean, that's like, if you're introducing like the sky, you're not going to say the sky's blue because everybody just knows.
Oh,
that.
Stop it.
That's fair. All right. Okay. You got me.
So Sterling and I, to be just bit fair, like we've known each other for a really long time. And Sterling is one of my most favorite people on the whole planet that I never get to talk to.
That's fair.
You know, here
we are. We went through a lot together when Sterling came into our master's program. Because we were still kind of inventing it. And
yeah, that was like the gears were just starting to turn.
Second year. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So it's better now, Ster. Yep.
A lot of laughs, a lot of tears.
Oh my gosh.
Tears of joy.
Sometimes other tears.
Yeah, absolutely.
A lot of pizza. A lot of pizza.
Mm-hmm. A lot of pizza. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. And I don't know if Corinne remembers, but there was something very unique about myself while I was attending the University of Utah. I had the option, an opportunity to be the PlayStation student ambassador.
I remember that.
And Corinne was absolutely amazing in letting us being able to come into the studio and have different events where we showcased different PlayStation titles, the console that was coming out, and the Vita too. So it was absolutely amazing.
Oh my gosh, the Vita. Oh my gosh. Okay, we're old.
That dates us more than the like C2 comment. It's like, hey, do you remember the Vita?
Yeah, when I tell everybody my favorite console ever was the Dreamcast, that really
It was mine too. I think that's why we're like kindred spirits, because yes. Oh man, it was
the game.
It was ahead of its time. Absolutely ahead of its time. Yep. It was so great.
Yep. So, well, Sterling, we're so happy to have you here. I'm so happy to see you. And I'm sure our students and our friends and whomever is going to listen to this is going to be super excited to hear what you've got to say. But we do tend to have a list of questions that our students have contributed to ask you specifically about being a producer. So
I have one right out of the gate, which was related to what Sterling said earlier, where he said diving right into what he has done and what he does. A lot of people, Sterling, especially people who are just getting into the games industry and just kind of figuring it out, they hear the word producer and their brain makes like a connection of like, I know what producing is and I know what produce is and I know these things, but but maybe that there's often a disconnect between those two. So right out of the gate, in layman's terms, what does a producer do? And if I may load the question a little bit, why are they so important to the games industry?
Absolutely. So that's an excellent question, Adam. Here's also something that's very interesting, and the differences between Pipeworks producer and an EA producer. EA producers are very, very different than the rest of the industry producer and production staff. I would say when you look at EA as a producer, if you're looking at those job roles, it is a hybrid between a designer mm-hmm. and an actual producer. Okay. EA has a track, what's called a development directors. The development directors at EA are your more traditional producers where they manage scope, set up sprint reviews, sprint planning, poker planning, being able to keep everything on track, seeing how we're, if we're behind or ahead on where we're in terms of plan, as well as making sure our backlog's looking good, how we're looking for launch, post-launch, if we have localization, all of that. So they're basically keeping everything on the rails so the thing doesn't explode, so the projects don't explode and go too crazy, right? They're also the managers in terms of when it comes to feature creep, being able yes. to make sure they head all that feature creep off at a head. So that's what a development director does at EA. It's very typical to what other producers do within the standard rest of the gaming industry.
Sure.
Now, when I started off at EA, I started off as a development manager, which is the entry level of the development director path. So that's traditional producer production skills. They ended up moving me to the producer role. They said because I have a personality that's able to meld with others and I keep everybody really excited and very happy. And so they ended up moving me to the producer role in particular because I was the launch director for NBA Live 14, which was a huge deal because EA hadn't launched an NBA title in about 4 years. Wow. And we were one of the few teams that actually had a huge, heavy competitor of 2K, right? Because 2K yeah. NBA was just taking over the industry at that point. Madden didn't have a competitor. NHL didn't have a competitor. FIFA had a little bit of a competitor with PES. But mm-hmm. from that aspect, we were one of the few teams that were actually trying to take down a monster. And so being the launch director of NBA Live 14 was a huge feather in my cap of being able to be like, hey, I was part of the team that helped EA get this game back into its portfolio and be able to launch properly. Very from there, cool. though, they said I did such a great job at being able to have that engagement with first party in terms of Microsoft and Sony that they ended up sliding me over into a live services opportunity mm-hmm. and where I then transitioned from being development director into that producer title and role and responsibility. And then all from there for the next 7 years, six and a half years, it was all live services. Live services on NBA, live services on Madden, live services on mobile titles. And because of that, I was able to then expand my own personal growth and responsibilities. And I don't tell this to many people because when I say it, people are like, oh, there's no way you did all that. But let me just let you in on some insight. And Corinne will probably agree and be like, oh, that sounds like Sterling. Yeah, I could see Sterling doing that. So NBA Live 14, I was the only person that was designing, implementing, and creating all of the Ultimate Team content for NBA Live. There was myself, an artist, and a QA guy. So not only did I have to formulate my backlog, I had to structure and coordinate with the NBA on terms of our programs of when they were released. I had to make sure that our user paths and our economy, how it was built and structured, was all it was all in tune and had to constantly be doing that. So it was a lot of work. It was
I am not surprised, but I'm stunned. And not surprised that you took yeah. it on. You know, it's so funny though. It's like, you're so good at getting teams to work together. And of course they put you on a tiny team.
Yeah, get the team of three people to work right. together.
Yep, absolutely. And it was so funny when they did that. It was, I'd still work with the development group because he'd be like, all right, so here's a list of features that we can bring in. here's a list of 10. Choose one that you want to have for next cycle. And so it was, you know, being able to work with them too. And it's so funny because then it leaked out that I had an IT background. So, for those of you that don't know, Corinne knows, yep, she remembers, is before I came to the video gaming industry and got my master's degree, I had spent almost 10 years in information technology and was a network engineer. I've done help desk, all sorts of that prior to coming to the gaming industry. It's a very technical mind. And so I'm able to see and diagnose things a little bit earlier on. I think that's what was such a good fit for the producer program at, you know, the University of Utah, and also where I am at now in my career too.
You always really got invested in what you were working on, no matter what it was. And so I think that's actually one of the hallmark skills of a really good producer, but it's also like, that means you can learn, and then they make you learn new stuff all the time.
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure.
Oh my gosh. I can't believe that. Wow. So I can understand why you probably got done with that and then decided to go to try something really different. So tell us a little bit about Pipeworks.
Yeah,
absolutely. So Pipeworks, I stumbled across them because they are actually helping out on Madden.
We
had them as an engineering core group, and they were helping out with new features that we were bringing in back on, I want to say it was Madden 18. And for a little bit, we brought them in for a little bit of a project. And so I got to know a few of those individuals. And then as the years went on, I went back away from the Madden team, was back on the NBA when we were launching back again, because that 17 year was really weird for NBA. We didn't have a product that went through. And so that's where I helped out Madden for a hot minute, got to meet some individuals at Pipeworks. And then I was actually moved to NBA Mobile. And that in the mobile game is a different beast in and of itself, because those games honestly never sleep. And we were more global than we were on the NBA console scale too.
Right,
we had
titles
and SKUs in China and Japan as well that I had to help manage and work with. But yes, Pipeworks is an amazing little studio. And I say little studio as of until last week. And I can go into a little bit about that of an announcement that just happened. And so it came to a point where if I can dive a little bit into how EA was for me. EA is a great company, an incredible studio to be able to work for. The benefits are amazing. They're really trying to change everything that has happened in the past, everything that was bad, you know, with the EA spouse letter that had gone out. So they've done a lot better of a job in making sure that there's a good separation of work-life balance. However, here's the caveat, that does not happen in live services.
Doesn't happen.
I never ever felt like I could disconnect. And there were so many years. And like I said, so NBA Live 14, 15, and 16, it was all three of those years back to back annual releases. And not only was I finalizing the previous year's content, I was then having to build the next year's content on top of that. It became very draining. Very, very draining. And it got very discouraging how year after year, it was like, oh, you're doing great. Everybody loves working with you. You've got such an upbeat personality. No matter how many things are going wrong, you're that steady, calm ham that comes in and everybody can go to you and they talk about problems. But we're not sure if you're quite ready yet to go to that next step. And people can only hear that for so long until they're like, okay, well, it is obviously time for me to look for something else. And right before I moved from EA, I was brought over as the business owner for all of Madden Ultimate Team, or Madden Live Services. So not only was I dealing with Ultimate Team, but also a new feature that came in the yard, and it dealt with in-game cosmetics. What was really interesting about this aspect is it branched not only mobile and console. And so you're wondering, oh, why'd they bring Sterling in? It's because I've had mobile and console experience, right? So it kind of fit. But yeah, it was again, I had management changes so frequently. So in my 8 years here at EA, I had over 17 managers.
Oh my gosh.
Exactly. Wow. So no one can have really like a steadiness on a year-to-year basis. It was, so you're looking at it every 6 months, it's changing, right? On average.
That's insane.
Of when I was getting a new manager. Yeah, it was, and it was really difficult because each manager that comes in has different management styles. And then every time they come in, it's almost like they need to hit a reset button.
And new priorities and all kinds of
priorities and how they think you can grow and what they think you need to do differently to grow and get to that next level. And through all that, I can honestly say that I had, of those 16, four very impactful managers that helped actually guide and made me a better person, a better producer. And through that, it was through those great mentors and managers that I had, those four, that I was able to be like, you know what? I am definitely better than this. One of my managers, he brought me in and he said, well, unfortunately, we're not able to promote you. He's like, and I fought for you, but you're better than this. And you need to actually start taking care of you because EA has dubbed you a lifer and they don't ever think you'll leave.
Yeah, they're wrong.
They're wrong. Absolutely wrong. Absolutely wrong.
Oh my gosh, Sterling. I'm so happy about hearing that.
Yeah, I am very happy. Very happy.
But I'm really happy that you're not there anymore.
Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Oh, I just had to take a quick drink. So hopefully
yes.
that didn't
yes. Well, you know, one of the things that we get all the time, especially, and you remember what this is like when you come into the program, it's like artists have a thing they do and engineers have a thing they do and technical artists do both of those things in some ways. Right. Yep. And, but producers frequently come in and they don't quite know what their role is. They know that they're supposed to do maybe burn down charts or something like that. But, I feel like producers are the hub around everything else that spins, right? And so what would you, if someone was like, if you were, had someone that came in that was a producer that was entry level, what advice would you give them? I kind of sometimes wait to ask this until the end of the interview, but I feel so, I mean, I know why producers are so critical because we have certainly seen a lot of studios that don't have them and we can see the problems that are created. But EA has always had producers and they tend to have a lot of producers, which 16 managers over.
Yeah.
So
I have 8 bosses.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So if you were going to give someone advice about not necessarily at EA, but just in general about being a producer, do you have any like words of wisdom for them so they're less stressed out about what they do?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, I have been a manager of other producers that are also coming into the industry, you know, directly from school too. The first thing I like to do with them is I like to sit down, being able to understand where they want to grow, how they think they can help the team. And the first thing I really tell them is make sure you have empathy. Continue to grow on empathy. Continue with that skill set and understanding of people, because so many people are coming from different areas of life. And you may have one of those that you're going to interact with that is frustrated, that have been there for years, haven't been promoted. They feel like they're a cog in the wheel. Making sure your teammates feel like they have a voice. And that became very clear early on when I was wrapping up my thesis project too, right? Is making sure individuals felt like they were contributing and had a voice and not feeling like they were cast out to the side. Because at the end of the day, we know the project needs to go out, but once you start building up those relationships of trust as a producer, your team will go to battle for you. And Kryn, you've seen that, right? With the different projects that I was on. It's being able to build those relationships of trust with them first and foremost. The other skills, those can all be taught. You can understand how burn charts are down. You can understand how to be able to, because there's different phases of risk. Like, and as you go through as a producer, like you'll become a Mary, like more aware of, oh, that's a potential risk. So then you'll start surfacing it. You'll start surfacing it up to higher producers who have been, you know, in those situations where they've had to deal with those risks. And then you'll start understanding, okay, I see this risk. Let me mitigate against it, right? These are some options that I think we can do. And then from there, you're then able to not only then surface the risk, mitigate against it, but then you'll be able to take that next phase and next step of being able to create the plan and put it into action. So then that way you're not just raising your hand and being able to let the leadership know what's going on. You're like, here's the issue that I saw. These are the steps I've took. This is the path we're going through. This is the direction we're going to go in. And this is why it's going to help us. Being able to answer the why are we doing this, who are we doing this for, and how are we going to do it, just remember to keep those phrases in your mind, and it will help you continue to grow as a producer and as a person, right? But that's definitely something that I always tell new individuals that are coming out. It's just being able to make sure you understand that we're all people. And as we mentioned very early on, producers are entirely different than engineers. They think differently. They're different than artists. They're different than the designers. But they are the glue that keeps the team together. They need to be malleable in their personality to understand the problems the engineers are having, being able to help them look for, you know, being unblocked with anything that they have. And also, if it's just like, hey, I see you're stuck on this. I need you to go outside with me for a minute and let's go change scenery. Because that's one thing I've noticed is the engineers, they become so focused, and having been one myself previously, a lot of them don't want to let other people beat them. And when I say that is, yes, it's in code, but code has to start from a person somewhere. And I say this and some people are like, what, really? Engineers are really competitive. They're probably some of the most competitive people I have met.
I certainly think game engineers are that.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Because they don't like other people's code beating them. Right. And what I mean by that, if they get stuck and they're trying to figure out a function or a call or why it's happening or not working, they get really frustrated really quickly because they're like, somebody else wrote this and I know I can fix it or I know I can get through it. So being able to separate them from that moment of insanity and being able to get them to calm down, talk through that with them, be able to present different insights on how they could work around it is also very beneficial too. Me personally, when it comes to my teams that I've worked with and that I've grown over the years, is I'll work with the designers and make sure I get a clear understanding of what the overall design is going to be. Then as a producer, I'll go and I'll sit down with the engineers and I'll be like, I'll tear it out. Like, okay, here's what we want to be able to have overall. Now, if we could get everything into this design, that's a tier 3. What can you give me if that's a tier 1? Here's what I've listed out here. Here's tier 2. And a lot of the times, once you start building up those relationships with your team, they'll be like, oh, I can't do it like this because that will take me twice as long. Mm-hmm. But I can give you a different option that almost gets the same result, but it's going to be a lot quicker and a lot better for our projects. And 9 times out of 10, when I've been in those situations, the designers are always like, oh, I think that might be better. I think that might be better. And so all of that is from, you know, making sure that you're human with people and build up those relationships of trust. So they trust you.
Yeah, I think, and you know, I have seen that over the years, and it's from the first team making a tiny, like the first game they've ever made. That is exactly what somebody has to fill that role, even if there's not a dedicated producer, you know, but all the way up, everybody I know that's in the game industry is, you know, somebody is filling that role, whether they have that title or not. But you're right. Yeah. I love that you said empathy, because I think that that's such a critical thing.
And it's something I think, oh, sorry.
No, go ahead, Adam.
I was gonna say, it's something I think a lot of producers that I've worked with and spoken with, I'm not saying they lack it, because hopefully all humans possess a degree of empathy. But it's something that I think a lot of the times producers can get into the mindset of just like, I'm here to make the machine turn, and like, and that's what's going to happen. And there is that degree of it. But when you miss that human element, there's a difference between being a taskmaster and being a producer, right?
Yep,
and I think you hit it right on the head when you mentioned the empathy thing, because that is, I think, the core difference.
Yep. Because there are three, you know, key aspects of a producer where they look at the three P's. And I know we talked about it in the master's program as well. And that's still the same in the industry, right? Mm-hmm. It's people, it's process, or it's project. And producers typically fall within those different areas. I'm definitely a people person. I consider myself more of people and process, because if I get those individuals and those team members built up, it's going to make the processes a lot easier, which then at the end of the day, you're going to be able to hit a lot of your project deadlines. So that's how I look at it in terms of myself. Other people, I've seen it where they're strictly process and project. They burn their team out. They alienate their team. And then it causes resentfulness between team members. And then people are like on the floor coming to me being like, I really don't like working with my manager. How can you help me work better with him? and why can't I work with you? And I'm like, okay,
well, right.
let's take all these questions. let's work through it. So,
you know, I think you're 100% right, Stir. Those three things for a really solid producer, you have to be able to do. Maybe not. I mean, maybe you, like you are, you're far more people oriented, mm-hmm. But if you don't have at least some of that, if you are all product oriented, you're not a producer.
Correct.
You know, Amy, you know, Adkins, who used to teach for us, and she was also a producer designer at EA. Mm-hmm. She would talk about the heart, like the producer is the heart of the game. And so, you know, you have to keep this like little precious thing inside of a box and protect it, because you're the one that always remembers that, because everybody's going to try to take a piece away of it. And I love thinking about that as producers, because, you know, I was not a producer in games, but I was absolutely did project management my whole career before I was an academic. And so I think that translates so well across all things games. I feel like the game stuff is like higher stakes in a weird way, because so many people see what you're doing when you're at a big place like EA. What are you? So tell us what you're going to do at Pipeworks. I'm excited to hear about that.
Yeah. We had a little bit of announcement this last week that happened. So Pipeworks was a very, very small studio. They're based out of Eugene, Oregon. Probably the total size of the studio is around 150 people. And I'm smiling when I say that, right? Because I just came from Tiburon, where we're talking thousands of people are just at that studio alone, right? Mm-hmm. Just even on the NBA team, we had more people that were working on just the NBA title than is entirely at the Pipeworks studio.
Right.
Why? So here's another little insight to it as well. Sorry, one second. Let me get a drink.
Yep. You're allowed.
As you can tell, I love talking. But how it came to this. So I also want to share with the students as well. There was something that actually both Corinne, when I was talking with you and Roger, both of you mentioned it to me, and it always stuck with me. To make sure that you're consistently updating your resume and that you're always looking for opportunities on how you can grow and what the industry is showing out there for what other companies want. And so I've made sure to always keep that in the back of my mind. Now, to share with the students, I just pulled up all of the number of places that I had applied for. Now, this is also with someone who has 8 years of industry experience at EA, who has a master's degree in game production, who also has an undergraduate degree in software engineering and software engineering experience of 2 years. I had applied to 125 different openings within the last year.
Nice.
Wow.
I tracked those all down. And the reason why I did that is because once they close a job posting, all of that information, all of that data, all of what they're looking for gets taken down. Mm-hmm. And there is nothing more embarrassing than going into an interview with how many I was doing on a weekly basis and being like, now, what was this job for again? can you help me? Was this a live services producer or was this development producer? And you don't ever want to have that happen. So I encourage you, anytime you apply for a job, I have it in a Google Sheet where I write down the name of the company. I write down the date I applied. I also write down the dates of any rejections, the dates of any interviews. I take notes on my interviews. I'm pretty hard on myself. Yeah, just like a typical producer.
Producing your own life here.
Absolutely.
And it's interesting because you'll see insights with companies that the job posting and role is a little bit different than what it actually is once you get in and start talking more with the company and with the people about it. And so what led me to Pipeworks? So I had actually three different offers from.
I'm sure you did.
At the same time that came through.
Oh my gosh. That's like when you got your job at EA.
Yes. Yes, it was. Yep. It's just like when it rains, it pours. And then there's the desert of desolation, you know, in between then. But So that was something that was very exciting at the time. And why I chose Pipeworks is because I felt like I had a genuine connection with those individuals that I was interviewing with mm-hmm. on the very last interview that came through. Something that was also really unique that I'll share as well is during the last interview, there was an executive producer, a senior producer, and the production director at Pipeworks that I was interviewing with. And the production director stopped the interview about 30 minutes in. It was an hour interview long, stopped it about 30 minutes in. And he goes, we're going to end the interview here. So as you can imagine, I'm thinking in the back of my mind, like, oh my gosh, I totally bombed this. I thought it was going so well though. What did I do wrong? So then I'm start looking back through and I'm like taking notes. And I'm sweating. And he goes, Sterling, I consider myself a good judge of character. I see how you presented yourself. I see all the learnings that you've had, both good and bad, from EA. I see where you're wanting to be able to grow. I don't have any more questions. And I think we need to just stop interviewing you so you can ask us all the questions that you want. Let's pretend we're friends. Start asking us about the area because we like you and we want you.
Oh my gosh. Wow. That's amazing.
that was pretty amazing. Up until that point too, they were really easygoing. They're veterans that some of them had previously worked at EA uh-huh. and knew exactly what I had gone through. Mm-hmm. The struggles of a big company versus smaller studio. As well as I definitely got to tell how my loyalty to EA wasn't reciprocated. Like it wasn't mm-hmm. given back from EA to me. So that's kind of like what drove me there. But the feeling that I had also when I was interviewing with them, I'm like, man, this is going to be a great studio. They're a third party. So they are actually contracted out by some of the bigger studios. So we work on a lot of projects. Right now they're working on helping and on Madden 20. Mm-hmm. Being able to help with them. And we have a few more other unannounced titles and projects.
Oh, that's fun.
I'm currently working on. And one of them is that I'm helping with too. And so it's interesting how, I want to phrase this correctly, but I, for lack of a better term, I'm working less, but I'm more effective in my production role.
Yeah, I love that.
Because of everything that I had done at EA, right? In terms of that hybrid role at EA.
Yeah.
And it's really cool too, because I've got an associate producer and she's very new to the games industry and absolutely amazing. And she's definitely a Sterling personality, as you'll understand, Corinne, because Corinne and I had these conversations that, in fact, I'll never forget it. She pulled me into her office and she said, Sterling, not everybody has your personality. You need to understand that you can't hold them to a Sterling standard. So that stuck with me.
I remember that.
Stuck with me. And from that, that's made me be, you know, really to focus on the empathy and being able to understand more individuals and how I can help them grow rather than what my expectations are for them. Right. And she's great. And being able to ask questions. Don't ever be afraid of when you get to that new studio or that new opportunity, if it's in gaming or not, because the cool thing about production is, don't tell the designers I said this, but the great thing about production is the production industry as a whole is growing increasingly, and not only in gaming, mm-hmm. but also in military simulations. So MilSims, that's yep. incredible out here as well. It's also in businesses. Like if you want to see how big this is, search for individuals in LinkedIn that have a project management professional certification. Mm-hmm. And that will tell you how big the production industry itself is. I know when students are coming out, they're like, oh, but I've got this opportunity and it's not in gaming. That's fine. That's absolutely fine. Because even at my time at EA, we brought in individuals that were from all walks of life that had a production focus on it. There were individuals we brought in from Allstate that were doing insurance previous. There were people that we brought in from military simulation companies at Cubic that was actually out here local in Orlando area. There's people we brought in from Universal Creative as well that were helping build roller coasters and user engagement aspects too. So it's huge.
Yeah.
And having a good solid producer in those areas is going to be able to affect and help those teams overall. So back to Pipeworks. It's an incredible opportunity. And this last week we were actually purchased by a company called Sumo Digital for $100 million. And so what was really awesome about this is it went from one tiny, small studio out in Eugene, Oregon, to now there are opportunities within the company that we have a head, we have a studio out in Vancouver. We have like 10 in England. We have some that are in India. And that was the whole reason about why they wanted to be able to get a foothold within North America and be able to start expand and looking to be able to grow the studio within North America as well. And so that was, it's incredible. So we're very, very excited. And now that takes our company of about 150 people to now just over 1,000, right? And so
well,
it's pretty exciting.
Well, that's still not as big as EA, but
it's still not as big.
But you're going to have such a great impact. I know you are. I know. I'm so happy for you. I'm so happy that I, you know, EA is complicated for
it is.
A lot of reasons.
It definitely is.
And I mean, you know, my number one priority is that you're happy. And so
I haven't stopped smiling.
I haven't stopped smiling.
This is going to sound probably a little bit mean, but the best feedback I've ever received when I was at EA was after I left.
I bet.
When I left, I had directors and an EP and other producers that were on the Madden team that reached out. They're just like, I can't believe you've gone. You were tremendous within the studio. You were always, you know, keeping everybody happy no matter what was going through. But some of the best feedback I got was a producer on the live services team that I was working with. And he's just like, I just want you to know that your team is in disarray ever since you've left. And I was like, I feel really good about this problem.
I've had that happen in my life a long time ago. And when you hear about that, you're like, I'm sorry for you.
But no, absolutely. I think that's actually like the mark of a good producer is like, how replaceable are you? Right. Or how devastated are people, or how in disarray are people? Because there can be people who can come and go, and then there can be people who it's like, oh no, like, because you've used it, I think you've used it more than once, the term like the glue that holds everything together, and oftentimes that's not realized until after the fact.
Absolutely.
Well, you would think that a big company like that would have learned that lesson 20 years ago and would value producers a little bit higher. But you know, it's, sir, I mean, and you know that, and this has not changed, that a lot of our students have a real, I guess prejudice is the only word I've got about, they want to go AAA. And we tell them all the time, you know, there's probably more opportunity to really be impactful at smaller studios, at indie studios, at, you know, look around, try new things. You don't have to go to Blizzard, and you don't have to go to Ubisoft. Correct. And you don't have to go to EA. Correct. Or Activision, or, you know, there's so many other things. But I also think that those big companies work well with some people, and for some people they don't. I don't think I would have ever, my whole career, including EAE, is like a startup, because, you know, that's the way I've, and so hearing about that, you know, you're just one of the cogs in the big machine. We try to help our students understand that they can, you know, they can choose. But I think at that first job, I mean, you were not 24 when you got done with your master's degree. So you had already spent time and you were ready to do something big. And I think that's why EA worked for you. But I think when you get older, you start to realize, I really want to do this other stuff. So I'm so excited for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
absolutely.
I can't wait to see like all the cool stuff that you're going to do with Sumo. So
yes. Very, very exciting. And yeah, my job has changed entirely. Like I said, now I'm more on that traditional producer aspect. So I'm looking at the backlog. I'm making sure the team, you know, stays on the rails, doesn't go off track on what we're looking for, making sure we curb feature creep, making sure we adhere to the project. And it's so interesting too, because even though we have some people that have done gaming for years, they're always like, well, why do I need to put estimates in? It's just like, so we get a better sense overall of how the project's landing and how it's coming in.
So we don't have to crunch at the end when we realize they were wrong.
Yep, absolutely.
So yep. Sterling, this is a question that's uniquely suited to you because of your personality. How do you balance being like a friend and being friendly versus being a boss or a manager, and like, when do you bring the hammer down and when do you not, and how do you bridge that gap?
Sure, absolutely. So I work with what's called a 7-to-1 approach.
Okay.
I bring up 7 great things that individual is doing before I come in with the one where we need to work on. And that starts from the beginning, right? It starts from when I'm discussing and building those, you know, those bridges of trust, right, with the team and with the group as well from that front. And there's also times as well, as Corinne and I used to call it, when Dark Sterling, you know, needs to come out, because there are times where that needs to happen. And it catches people off guard from time to time, because I'm typically so upbeat, but there are times where it's just like, look, no, we are not doing this. This is why, period, the end, we're continuing on in this path. Otherwise you're going to kill the team. And I refuse to have my teams killed. Having killed myself over the years, I see those, like we talked about earlier when we're talking about risks and how to mitigate and be able to maneuver around those too. And I would shut those down very early on. And to some of the surprise of my managers at the time, right? And they're just like, well, we want it to happen. It's just like, I understand you want it to happen. However, we have done this previously, and the user sentiment and user engagement tells us that we don't need to have this happen, because some of these programs that we launched weren't nearly as successful as those that we actually took time on and let people recuperate. There was something that a study that I'd done during my master's program where I looked into how long can people really push themselves during work-life hours of being able to make sure that they're successful. And it was about 50 hours that they found, that studies found, about 50 to 55 hours. And then the drop off after that was so significant that you were getting such diminishing returns. Sure. And that's always something that I'd keep bringing up to the forefront. I'd be like, hey, my team's hitting 50 hours. We can't keep doing this. My team's hitting 50. And so by the third week, I'd be like, okay, we've hit 50 hours for 3 times now, for 3 weeks in a row. We're not doing it again. I'm letting my team go at 40. I don't care where we're at. And so a lot of that has come back, you know, on me, but at the same time, you need to protect the people, because if you don't protect your people, then you're going to see a lot more job openings and postings, and you're going to have to go through more training, and you're going to have to lose more time to be able to ramp more people up. And so I think, EAA, the team that I was on started to see that as I was leaving. But you can get, nice. Start to get a sense of when you need to turn that on and start shutting things down earlier. Now, in particular with individuals, like I said, it's that empathy key, right? Being able to understand where individuals are at, then that way it gives you a quicker gauge of knowing when you need to bring in additional help or when you need to have a discussion with human resources, right? There was a period of my career where they called me the Grim Reaper.
Oh.
Because of individuals that weren't contributing to the team or to the project, or would leave for hours during the day, but still clocking 40, that they would be like, okay, if you need to have difficult conversations with any of your personnel, bring in Sterling. Because I'd have those keys of like 7 great things, 1 hard thing, mm-hmm. 7 great things, 1 hard thing. It's like, hey, I see all of your engineering is coming in on this. The tests are looking great. Where smoke screens are passing. This is it. However, you can't just disappear in the middle of the day and not tell everybody where you're going. You need to be able to be communicative. We're adults here. You need to be able to tell us what's going on. It's like, oh, well, I had to go pick up my son from daycare. It's just like, great. Instant message us. More than happy to be able to work around with that and be able to help you out as a person. But you definitely need to set up a, this is who I am at work versus this is who we are afterward.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that was a little bit difficult for me to understand early on when I was in the producer track at EA. Because like I said, I was the guy that was just designing it, working on the backlog, scheduling timelines and everything. And so I just went into a design review. And one of my mentors, one of my great friends to this day, just destroyed my design, just absolutely blew it up. And I was so frustrated. And we came out of that meeting and I went back to my desk and I was, and Corinne knows when I get upset, I go quiet. I go bright red in the face and I am fuming on the inside. Right. And he comes to my desk and he's just like, hey man, you ready to go to lunch? Like nothing happened. And I'm like, I want to kill you right now. What are you doing? And he looks at me and he goes, you and I need to go have a conversation. And I said, okay. So he went into the room and he goes, Sterling, I love you. He says, but you cannot take designs personal. He's like, the moment you start doing that, we're making Sterling's NBA Live, mm-hmm. and we're not making EA's NBA Live.
Right.
And he's just like, and also, if I don't do those things where I find edge cases that could cause issues within the game, I'm not doing my job. And then I'm failing you as a manager. And I was like, wow, I feel like such a jerk right now. but thank you for explaining that to me, right? So you definitely have to understand that it's not your game, that you want to be able to help the team overall, making it a success. And that's where I come back again to making sure you understand who you're working with, and knowing how you can help them is going to make the project overall better. Because then you can have each other's backs, because then it's just like, okay, yeah, next time you need to go pick up your kid from daycare, absolutely, let me know. And I can bring another engineer that can help answer questions, or we can, you know, look at bringing another person onto the project if you can only hit, you know, 20 hours this week if you have to leave or whatever. So it's definitely another producer tool set, or a tool to be able to have in your tool set, is communication, both verbal, both body language too, because your team will pick up definitely on your body language, because you could be saying something else and they're just like, that's not true. And then also definitely written, because so many times I've been in direct messages with another person and I'm just like, wow, did he really mean that to me? And I'll go to his desk and I'll be like, hey, this came off as super passive aggressive. And he's just like, no, I am so sorry. I didn't mean that any way, shape, or form. I'm trying to balance three things. And it's just like, oh, okay, cool. Let me realign with you really quickly, and we can carry on. So
I love that you completely unprompted said how important communication is, because that is like the soapbox I'm on 100% of the time. Because a lot of people think that they don't need to worry about that, you know, that it's everybody will understand if you put a winky face on the end of your emoji, you know,
correct.
Your winky face, yeah. And everybody will be like, oh, then you really weren't really mad at me, but then all the words that you used are really mad at me.
Yep.
So I love that. And empathy. Yep.
I also just really love how you mentioned, like you said the word team a jillion times today, which is a very, very important thing. And I really like how you talk about, you know, when you phrase something with someone, it's your actions have an adverse effect on all these other people. It's not just, you know, this that's going on. It's a trickle down effect.
Yep.
And I think of every discipline, production probably needs to have the strongest grasp of that concept. Of the team working together and the team affecting one another. Because yeah, if the producers aren't aware of that, then how are the engineers going to be aware, yep. of it? Or how are the designers going to be aware of it?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Gosh, I can't believe we're out of time.
That's terrible.
It just went too fast.
So Corinne, we had talked about it before. Do we want to do the lightning round?
Sure.
Should we? Yeah. All right.
You do it.
All right, Sterling. Okay, we'll put 5 minutes on the clock. I have no idea if there's actually going to be a clock right there. And I have no idea if this is actually going to be 5 minutes.
There's probably not going to be a clock.
Probably not. Okay.
I'll look. I'll watch.
All right, Sterling. So you ready for this? We'll go through a couple quick questions at the very end, because there's obviously way too many to answer in any amount of time.
Well, if you want to send them to me afterward as well, I can reply to them in email too. No problem with that. So.
Oh. Thanks.
Well, hot thing. Yeah, we'll definitely take like the best ones that we don't want to get around to.
Well, I think what we need to do is have you back.
Oh, I'd love to come back. Absolutely.
A Sterling.
As you can tell, I love talking.
Well, I love talking to you, so.
Likewise.
All right. So, a couple quick questions really quickly. How, in your opinion, how avoidable is crunch, and when it happens, who is responsible for it?
Crunch is always avoidable, in my opinion. It comes down to producers in terms of scheduling it out and being able to come up with a game plan that makes your team more effective and better on it. It also comes down from leadership that may not understand the true area of the game that your team is working for. So it comes down to the producer making sure that crunch is held accountable. And if crunch happens, it's a failure on the producer.
It's a really good answer.
I love
and
that.
A lot of pressure to put on
it
the
is.
Shoulders.
Yeah.
I was going to ask the next one. Sorry, Adam.
No, go for it.
So Sterling, you talked about protecting your team from working over 50, 55 hours. How many hours a week were you working, and how many hours a week are you working now?
I am working now 40 hours a week.
Nice. Yeah, I bet your wife and your kids really like that.
Love it. Yeah, absolutely love it. It's so funny because as we talked a little bit about it, I'm on Pacific Coast time, even though I'm on the East Coast, and I'm still getting off my machine earlier than when I was at EA.
I thought that might be true.
As crazy as that sounds. There were periods where I was working up to 100 hours consecutive weeks. Burnout was always readily there right behind me. There was a lot of hours that were pumped in, being an only person that was creating, you know, and managing all of NBA Live Ultimate Team 14, 15, and 16. Thankfully, because of going through that, I've made sure that my team members never experienced that. Because even working 10-hour days is brutal. But when you're hitting 18-hour days, and there were periods where I would go straight 36. That's not healthy for anybody because then it makes me less effective that following day.
I feel like maybe the EA spouse thing, like, can I write a letter to them? I mean, you're not working there anymore, but stop it,
yeah,
EA.
It's unfortunate because it's still relevant in very small aspects of it, especially, like I said, in live operations.
They should not have let that happen to you. Yeah, that's wrong.
What software and techniques do you use? Like, I know we talk about, like, you know, Jira is a standard thing. In your personal life, what softwares and techniques work for you? Are you a burn down chart guy, a chart guy? Are you a Gantt chart kind of guy? Are you a, you know, whatever?
I'm a burn down. Okay. I'm a burn down type of guy. I work in Jira, love Jira. If Jira is not set up properly for the project, you can make it worse and more difficult for you to be able to work in. It is one of the strongest tools. It can be strong working with you or strong working against you on how it's set up. Getting a good understanding, I'd recommend, you know, students taking the time and maybe taking a couple of courses in Udemy if they want to be able to start furthering their understanding of Jira. And I believe Jira has like student options for students to be able to jump in and start digging into.
Yep, they do.
So it's also that, work in, you know, spreadsheets as well on that front too, from Excel spreadsheets or to Google Sheets, of being able to have clear communication and collaboration between different parties. I worked previously with localization as well, and so being able to have those spreadsheets were critical on the success of the overall team and group. Let's see, what else? All of the Microsoft Office suites, in particular my calendar.
Right.
My calendar is definitely a tool that I use consistently. And it's also not just using my calendar, but being able to understand and how to look when good times are to schedule meetings for your team, right? You want to make sure that you're not interrupting their days. If they have long periods of break, you don't want to set a meeting like right in between those long periods. If they don't have anything on their calendar, I mean, you want to make sure that you schedule it closer to something where they already have another meeting. That way it gives them a longer time to be able to make sure they're finishing up and wrapping up what they want to be able to do for their own personal goals or for that particular sprint. Yeah.
Awesome. Are you still playing video games?
I am still playing video games. Good. Yes, indeed. And a lot of them.
What are you playing right now?
I'm just finishing up again. I just got the complete series of Lego Harry Potter.
I loved those.
Just wrapping up that on Xbox so I can make sure I'm a completionist. So I'm trying to get it to be 100% right now.
I didn't know that this was actually going to happen, but look what I have on my desk.
What? That's amazing. I love it. That's awesome.
You need to get it for your kids. It's an advent calendar.
Oh, so cool. I need to. That's amazing. I'm playing Fortnite with my kids as well. And that's something that's pretty cool. I love being able to play video games with my kids and know what they're playing. We're just picking up Last of Us. Mm. So we're just going to.
Yeah, not for Riker.
Not for Riker. Definitely not that. Not at all. And then I'm also teaching my kids League of Legends too. So we're jumping in. So they're all learning how to play that, including Riker on that one as well.
Tell them that who knows what'll happen when they're in college, but you know, that's one of our esports
games, indeed.
Could get a scholarship.
And I'm still playing Pokemon Go with my kids.
Oh, nice.
Like I make sure we get out during COVID and go catch Pokemon and go on walks.
Oh, I'm sure Laura would love to hear that.
Yeah.
All right. And the last question, what do you wish you had known before starting your career as a producer?
Who? What did I wish I would have known?
I've finally been able to stump him. He's had like the this perfect answer one. For everything. And now I feel victorious.
No, I mean, this aside, like what was really great about EAE is it was almost a precursor to what the industry was. So, I mean, thankfully, the faculty put me on a team where it was some interesting and conflicting personalities. So I had the opportunity to learn about that before I got into the industry. I think for me in particular, like very early on in my career, something that I wished I would have learned quicker is not feeling like I needed to do everything myself.
Mm. Ooh, really good.
I love that.
Yep. Being able to understand more of myself early on and when to cut it off. Because like we talked about those 100 plus hours and what did it result to?
You're happy working for Pipeworks.
Indeed. Yep. Absolutely. So happy. Haven't stopped smiling.
Oh yeah. Thank you so much, Sterling. And we really will have you back. We're going to be doing this a lot. So
that's awesome.
Podcast. So, okay.
That's awesome.
Bye.